I've pushed the button. Yep, we're good.
Okay, good.
Good. So we just cut off the beginning of the recording, but anyways, we'll get started. Matt, how are you this evening?
I'm doing fantastic. How are y'all?
Doing good. You're in Tucson, Arizona?
Tucson. I'm helping, I've got a friend of mine that's doing some floor work, and so I just came out to help him out and see the beautiful city of Tucson again that we lived out in. It's beautiful. So.
And where's Mr. Eddie this evening?
He is, as I understand it, in California on a trail ride. So it's one of the trail rides that old Mr. President Ronald Reagan went on whenever he was still with us. So he's out there enjoying the beautiful city of California on trail ride.
Working, I'm sure.
Working very hard, I'm sure.
All righty, Matt, what do we got?
All right, well, first up, we're going to go ahead and see if Les is available. So, Les, actually, I just misspelled your name. There we go. Les, you are unmuted and good to go.
Good to go is right. How are you guys doing tonight?
Hi, Les.
Hi, it sounds like you're on a washing machine. Oh, there's
somebody's got some static. There we go.
So I've got a question for you, and it's just a review question, because I remember hearing about the $100 IRA deal, and I went back through my notes and couldn't find it, and tried to find it online with you guys, and was not successful. So I thought I'd just go back to the source and find out, you know, get a review of how that works and if it's good for performing and non-performing or just one or the other. So anything you can tell me would be a big help, because I've got a Roth 401k now that I'm ready to start using.
Okay.
All righty. Well, Zarina, you want to go?
Oh, yeah, I'll take this one. Okay, so the $100 model was built on, first of all, for performing notes.
Okay.
And one of the reasons we don't do a lot of, you know, brokering or selling non-performing notes to just investors is because most of them don't know how to do it or how to work it out. So the $100 model is built on the concept of you buying a note in your IRA, let's say it's a $50,000 note, and then you're selling off a large enough partial that leaves you only with $100 left into the deal. So in this case, it would be $49,009.
Okay.
And you calculate that out. Okay, how many payments, you know, would I need to sell off of this particular note in order to pull this off? So this is a very front-heavy math equation before you do this, because sometimes you can buy a deal that doesn't have quite enough payments, or by the time you're done doing the $100 model, you've got like four payments left. So it's true. So you have to do a lot of the math beforehand. And one thing I know a lot of people get caught up on, and this is a kind of a pertinent question, is, well, what if I don't have all the money to buy the deal in the first place? Maybe I only have $10,000 in my IRA. Can I still do this? So the easiest answer is no. Just have all the money in there and do the deal. But I know that there's some people who that's just not possible. So in that case, you would have to set up some sort of escrow closing, meaning you have some kind of company or servicer or whoever, and you say, look, I've got this investor lined up, which is another sort of you must have on this deal. You've got this investor, let's say his name is Jim. I'm always picking on Jim.
Okay.
So Jim says, Les, you know, I want to put some money away into these notes that you've been talking about. You know, give me something under $50,000 or under X amount. So you find this $50,000 deal, but you've only got $25,000 in your IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you can do is set up an escrow and say, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do sort of like a simultaneous closing. You're going to fund, you know, $49,900, and I'm going to put in the other $100, and that's going to buy this deal, and then you write the same contract as you would a partial. So you would have the contract already signed with this guy. Everything's closing. Everything's going to the servicer. There's a lot of working parts for those of you guys who know how to do a closing. Which is why, you know, if you're not familiar with that kind of thing, we just say have all the money in there. Because if you've never done a closing like that before, it's really complicated to do a $100 model that way.
Hmm.
So to answer your question, Les, $100 model is this in a nutshell. You have a deal. You calculate the math saying, after $100, how many payments do I need to sell in order to give my investor a good return and to keep enough payments in here to incentivize myself to do this deal in the first place. You run the math. You go to your investor. You should have them lined up beforehand.
Sure.
And say, hey, Jim, I've got this deal. I can put you in here for $49.9 with a 7.5% return, 8% return, whatever you promise them. And he says, okay. And you do the deal, close it in your IRA, which you know is going to take a few days because you have to go through your custodian and get everything set up. And then you do a partial agreement, and you guys have that in your materials.
Right.
And you just say, okay, Jim is buying $49.9 from 123 Main Street, 8% return, blah, blah, blah. So it's really a huge, huge partial.
Got it. So I've done partials before where the investors basically funded the whole thing. So I've put in zero. So this sounds like the same kind of thing, except I'll put in 100 out of my IRA.
Exactly.
Or my 401k. So if I'm going to buy a note from you and you want to know who's the purchasing entity, it's my 401k.
Correct.
Correct. And then I can have, let's see, I don't know how to do the money exactly because my investor can't put the money into my 401k, but they could send the money directly to you. Yes.
To Colonial?
I'm not sure. That's where we do the, see, I've done this before without using your partial agreement. So that's where that would come in. They would send it to the person who's going to close the partial agreement, right? And they would hold it in escrow until it's all signed, sealed, and delivered?
Yep.
Okay. Cool. So why doesn't this work so well for non-performing? Or you would recommend not using it for non-performing?
Well, okay. So on non-performing, the person who's buying the note from you, essentially, would have to know how to work out that asset. Because when you buy a non-performing in your IRA, you need all of the funds available in that IRA to work out everything. You're not allowed to have any outside funds. So this kind of muddies those waters a little bit, and you don't want to do any kind of prohibited transactions.
Okay. Cool. I think I'm getting it. I can make this work.
Cool.
Thanks so much. I'll see you guys in Denver next weekend, I hope.
Okay, cool. Matt, you going to be in Denver next week?
Actually, next week I will have just made it to Dallas, Texas. So I don't know. So I'm gonna miss everybody out in Denver for that event, which I have some stuff I have to do in Dallas. So it's kind of getting ready for the summit and everything. So it's unfortunate that the timing was that way, but oh well. So I'll be there in spirit, I'm sure. So
okay, we'll try to make it work without you.
You can try. I'm not promising anything, but,
Yeah. Okay, have fun at Dallas. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.
Welcome.
Dorina, can you touch on the, because we might want to go back and talk on this, can you kind of touch on the reason why the $100 is required, as opposed, like he said, that he's done some purchases without any money in? Well, what's the reason for the $100?
The $100 is the minimum amount that you can be invested in with your IRA. You can't have $0 and just make, infinite returns with them. So the minimum that they'll allow is $100. It's just a requirement from IRA companies, 401k companies.
And
cool.
And Les, Lisa made a good point. You said you were looking for the stuff on the member site. Walter Wolford has his own little section of information and education. So if you click on Wolford's name, and thanks for that, Lisa, some of this information would be in there, and you maybe familiarize yourself with that also.
Excellent. Okay, that's one place I haven't really explored much, so thanks for that reminder.
You're welcome. Thanks, Lisa.
We don't know where it's at. Lisa knows where it's at.
What's that, Charles?
We don't know where it's at, Lisa. I said, we don't know where it's at. Lisa definitely knows where it's at. So, yeah, thank you, Lisa. Lisa has to keep us in line tonight.
She's always there behind the scenes typing up stuff, so it's cool.
And Keith and Zarina, Keith was asking, just to clarify, that's an IRS requirement, the $100?
It was a statement, yeah. The $100 is an IRS requirement. So Uncle Sam says you need $100.
And Uncle Sam doesn't play around when it comes to certain things.
what he says goes, right?
Yeah.
All right, so I think we're good on that one, so I'll go ahead and move to the next question. So our next question is coming from Ray. So let me check to see if Ray's on here. double check. Is this the right Ray?
Is this the right Ray?
Sorry, I didn't have the last name on here, so sorry about that. Here we go. All right, Ray.
I don't see him.
Oh, okay. Yeah, actually, I talked to Ray earlier today, and I think that he was not. We made the agreement that he's not going to be able to talk on the call, but he is going to be on the boards and respond with any questions and answers on the board to go over everything. So I'll just kind of hit the point of it. And Charles, this is something we've got. I've actually got the zoning citation here also. Okay. He has a.
Yeah, just go ahead and read through it, and we'll address it.
Okay, perfect. So.
Because Charles can't see.
Thank you, Zarina, for that vote of confidence.
Well, I mean, I could magnify it, but if I did that, we could only read it.
No, he's on the phone. I'll read it off for you, Charles. It says, good morning. I've owned a land contract in Fostoria, Ohio for a couple of years. The borrowers have started having troubles with their payment. They missed one payment, then caught themselves up and missed the next payment. The servicer has issued 3 notice letters at this point. In addition, I just received a zoning violation notification from the city of Fostoria regarding the borrower's parking in the backyard. When I called the zoning inspector, she had not contacted the borrower. She said if it was their policy to contact the landlord and fine the landlord. I explained the land contractor, but I'm still not sure she will change her position or notify the borrowers. I reached out to my servicer, and they said they will not contact the borrowers with regard to a zoning violation. The inspector also noted that the condition of the property is deteriorating. At this point, what should I be doing? And then he has a second issue, so let's kind of address that first.
Well, because it's an unrecorded land contract, I'm sure it's the title shows in Ray's name. So when they go to the city or the county records, that's they're pulling up Ray as the owner of the property, so he's the landlord. Some municipalities don't understand land contracts or how they work. It's funny because I had the same situation happen today, except I got a citation in the mail written by a police department saying that I was parking a car in the front yard and there was trash, and that they gave me 10 days to get the car out of the yard. So I contacted the borrowers and told the borrowers, introduced myself, told them who I was, that there was a citation that was issued because they have a car parked in front of their house, and that they probably needed to get that car moved because it would be towed, and if any citations are issued again or fines, that they're going to be responsible for those fines. Because it is their vehicle. So typically, and it was a car that was just, I don't even think the car had an engine in it, honestly. So the lady said, no, I'll get my husband, we'll get it moved and get it in the driveway. So I don't know if that's going to solve the problem, but at least it gets it out of the yard. But if your servicer will not contact the borrower, feel free to reach out to the borrower, because you got to get that citation taken care of. As far as, you know, the condition of the property deteriorating, you know, I would probably go ahead and order a property inspection just to see what the property condition looks like. In this case, you can't just say, hey, your house is falling down, you got to paint it. You need to go ahead and get a property inspection. According to this citation here, it doesn't appear that the city has issued any type of notice yet as far as violations, as far as the condition of the property, but it could be that would be happening. So I would probably go ahead, Ray, and have a property inspection, just a drive-by property inspection done, just to see what the condition of the property is. And then he said, goes on to, he says he has a second issue I have.
Yeah.
Is the borrower does not have property insurance, so each year I need force place insurance. Then the servicer adds the insurance to the bill of their, to their payment. This is a trigger that sets off late payments 2 years in a row. It says in the land contract that there should be an impound account for taxes and insurance, but it looks like the previous investor canceled it. Is it possible for the borrowers to reinstate or start an impound account for the property insurance? So, Ray, if a borrower is not making their payments, then you can have a escrow account put in place. So if you're forced placing insurance, your servicer needs to force place it or put an escrow account in place. So they're collecting payments. So basically what they're going to do is they're going to increase your borrower's payment. So, you know, make sure that, you know, when you do this, you got to understand the borrower's payments are going to be, so sometimes borrowers were struggling, will struggle at first when you have to increase their payments. But yes, because they're not paying their insurance or providing a policy, if you're force placing it, you can, and you're paying for it, you can have your servicer create an escrow account and start escrowing. And you can make that mandatory for the taxes and insurance. And I'm not sure if they're paying the taxes or not. I guess that was my question, Ray's not on the call, but if they're not paying their taxes, then you also want to escrow for those taxes as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you can put that escrow account in place.
That's interesting. So on something like this, Charles, where your servicer won't contact them, you can just go ahead and go around your servicer and contact them yourself.
Right, because really, if your servicer's not, and I'm not sure why a servicer wouldn't contact them. I mean, I've had servicers, you know, contact borrowers before for similar situations. But if your servicer doesn't contact them, you can just contact the servicer, I mean, the borrower, and let them know that you are the lien holder or the note holder, and that you were issued a citation, and that violation needed to be corrected, and they needed to correct it immediately. And then you could have a property inspection done 5 days later. Just say, look, y'all need to have this out within 5 days, or that car is going to be towed off, and then you're going to be fined. So any cost associated with removing that car, you're going to be responsible for. And
Charles,
so anyway, that's what I told my borrower. Huh?
You said we're going to take your whip.
I've taken a few cars before.
I'm sure you have. Russ pointed out a good thing. He said, not in North Carolina, in reference to if your servicer won't perform and you want to go around them and contact the borrower yourself, you can't do that in North Carolina because you need a debt collector's license. So in that case, you would probably just talk again with your servicer or get another one.
You could do that, and also, Russ, and I'll just... You know, Russ, that's a good point, because some states, they require a debt collector's license. But keep in mind also, you're not collecting a debt. All you're doing is telling them to get the car out of the yard before you have it towed. So keep in mind, you have to have a debt collector's license to collect a debt. But if you're calling because of a violation, you're not collecting anything. You're just telling them to get that vehicle out.
Okay. Good point.
And Russ, if you go to jail for that, just let me know, please.
You'd be like, I'll remember stop that one time you were on that call? Yeah, well, Russ went to jail.
Russ, they've never come put me in handcuffs yet, knock on wood. If I had some around here, I'd knock on my head. But never been put in jail yet for that, but I have called many of folks and told them you've got violations and you need to correct them. And that's that's one of the negatives on land contracts. You know, land contracts are a great instrument, but you got to keep in mind that when you have an unrecorded land contract, everything comes to you. So, you know, you'll get a water bill. I have to forward water bills to the customers because when I record a deed in my name, it automatically triggers the water bill to come to me, and I have to turn around and have my servicer send that water bill back to them to pay. So, So there's good advantages and there's some disadvantages. Yeah.
So that brings up a good point. So I was talking to him today, and that was an issue that he was wanting to touch on the call also. So right now he has a the utility bills or any like water, electric, or anything like that are coming to him. And what he's doing right now is paying for those utility bills and then having the servicer charge that the borrower for those expenses. Is that the best way to do that, or what would be the best way to have that
paid? No, the best way to do it is just to have the servicer contact the borrower and let them know that they need to notify the utility company to send the bills back to them. I mean, if your servicer doesn't mind doing it, that's fine, but I don't recommend it. I mean, that borrower needs to get, in sync with paying
their
bills.
I mean,
yeah, pay your own bills, pay your water bill, pay your electric bill. I don't get a lot of electric bills, but water bills is what I see a lot of. Typically, when you cut your utilities on, when you cut your electrical, and you cut that on in your name, But a lot of these municipalities, you have a water bill whether you use it or not. There's a water bill. I get water bills every day on non-performing loans as well as I do performing loans. And so some municipalities, you have to have the water owned, period. So my recommendation is have the servicer push back to the borrower and say, look, you need to get to contact the city for the water, for the electric, whatever bill you're referencing, and have them put it in their name and send the bill directly to them.
So, Charles, I know, and this was his point on that, is, I've ran into this with my property in Toledo. So with a land contract, what he is being told by the municipality is that because it's a land contract, they're not able to actually put the utility in their name. It has to be in his, who is the deed owner's name. So in that case, should he just change the billing address, and that should work?
Yeah, he could just, they can leave it in his name and just have it sent to the property address and let the borrowers know that the water bill is coming in his name. They just need to make sure it's paid. And again, if your servicer's doing that, that's fine. But, that could create a deficit in an escrow account somewhere down the road, and then the borrower's payments go up. And, I think if you can get the borrowers to pay it, it simplifies the bookkeeping on that. And, because you need to identify, what's taxes, what's insurance. Now you got what's water bills and what's electric bills. So it could get confusing down the road. So my recommendation is to push that back to your borrowers anytime you can. And if they won't change the name on it, at least have them put that address, your name, and then their address on it, and let that borrower know that water bill needs to be paid every month, because it's their responsibility. They're using the water. This is their house. The way the city municipalities look at it is a rent house. And I've never had a rent house that my tenants did not put the water in their name. I mean, I'm not going to pay their water bill. I'm not going to pay their electric bill. And so...
Well, speaking of paying bills, Raymond also says that his servicer will not impound. They'll impound for the taxes, but they won't impound for insurance.
I'm not sure. I don't want to know who the servicer is. But, if they're not, an impound accounts for taxes and insurance. So verify that, because I've never had a servicer tell me that they won't impound for insurance.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
If you're paying those taxes, if you have to pay those that insurance policy, they need to impound for those that insurance as well. So all servicers should be offering, is they pay taxes or impound for taxes and insurance. So please confirm with that they're not, and let me know. I'd be curious to see why.
Call them back and talk to somebody else. Because that sounds weird. Because that's kind of what the servicer is there for, is collect payments and impound stuff for taxes and insurance. So if they won't do insurance, maybe you explained it to them wrong. Maybe they thought that you were asking them to create an insurance thing, and they just said, we won't do that. Maybe that's what they thought you were asking.
Right.
So just call them back. That might be some sort of miscommunication going on with that.
So, Charles, can you walk through kind of the process of how you have the servicer require an escrow account, force an escrow account to a borrower?
Well, It's basically the servicer has to send out a notification notifying the borrower that they're not paying their taxes and their insurance, or that they've advanced the taxes and insurance on their account, and that they are going to place an escrow account. And basically they create an escrow analysis, and they have to notify the borrower in mail, in writing, in a certain period of time that effective this date, usually it's 30, 45 days out, effective this date, your new payment will be this amount. And basically they calculate the escrow payment for the arrearages, so taxes they've already advanced, plus what the following year's taxes are going to be. So a borrower's payment could jump considerably because they're basically collecting 2 years of taxes and insurance. So that what they're going to make sure of is that they paid $1,000 for 2015, okay? So now they know at the end of 2016 there's another $1,000. So instead of escrowing, you know, $1,000 or the payment divided by 12 of $1,000, they're going to take $2,000 and divide it by 12. And then at the end of next year, they will adjust that payment down to where, because it will be caught up. But mm-hmm. when I'm dealing with large amounts of taxes or a major increase in a payment, which could be $200, $300, I've had them jump as high as $500, $600. Ooh. So you can, yeah, and that typically will put a borrower in default, and that's what you got to make sure of. So you want to make sure that they take those taxes, the arrearages of the taxes that they paid, and they spread that over maybe 36 months instead of 12 months, have them spread it over 24, 36 months. That lowers that arrearage payment, but yet their coming year payment, they're going to calculate the full amount for the next 12 months on that. But anything in arrearage, it's always good to try to spread those over 24, 36 months, because you just don't want them to go into a payment shock. And again, I've got one now that they just increased their payment from $220 a month escrow to $540 a month. Borrower can't pay it. They've defaulted. Mm-hmm. So okay. Now I'm having my servicer go back, complete a new escrow analysis, and then spread that payment over 36 months, and I've actually gone even longer than that. So just depending, you know, again, you don't want to put a borrower in payment shock because it will cause a default.
Raymond came back and said he's asked the impound accounts for the insurance 2 or 3 times, and they said they won't do it because he didn't have insurance when he placed the note with them.
Okay. And Raymond, it may be time to start interviewing other servicers. Okay, so, I mean, you're the customer, and they're not paying their insurance. So it has to be, you know what, for years I paid my own taxes, my own insurance on my house. And I went to my servicer and said, look, can you just start escrowing that? Because I got tired of coming up with that payment every year. It's just easier to just pay it monthly in my payment. And my servicer took it, you know, my loan, and they set up an escrow for my insurance and taxes. That should not be a problem. Even if you don't have an escrow impound account, when you board a loan, there's no reason they cannot create an escrow account. And if they won't do it, then I would probably look at some other servicers.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I have them. I board loans every day, Raymond, that with servicers that have no escrow impounds. And it's not within 6 months I'm having them do escrow analysis. When they don't pay their taxes or insurance and I have to pay them, they're going to set up an escrow account for those taxes and insurance.
So this is a question from Co Horgan. And the question is, when it comes to utilities, violations, notifications from the city, stuff like that, does any of that show up in the payment history? And I guess they're asking, you know, if they could know that type of stuff in advance before buying an asset.
No, your taxes and insurance show up in a payment history when they're making payments. Right. You know, every servicer codes different transactions differently. I've never seen one that says light bill or water bill.
Right.
It typically says taxes, insurance, or it could say a miscellaneous. They may code it as miscellaneous. But it's really no way of determining in a pay history if they're paying a water bill or electric bill. And I've never seen it in all the pay histories mm-hmm. I review. Every every day, every week, every month. I've never seen one that says utility payment or something like that. It always, right. It could say miscellaneous, but there's a lot of different miscellaneouses in there. But, you know, even, I mean, force place insurance comes up as a insurance disbursement.
Right.
So, but I've never seen a disbursement that was labeled utility.
And guys, that's because it's not normal for you to be paying the utility. So they just cover P&I and taxes and insurance. So they're not going to have some sort of extra code or extra file for, okay, we paid this person's water bill last month. Let's put this in there. So,
yeah. Call my servicers, see if they'll add my utilities to my house, man. I just want to pay one thing.
I'm saying, man.
Just let me pay one payment, you pay everything, okay?
That's what I'm saying.
Saves me a lot of headache.
That would relieve a lot of headache, but that's not my job, so, you know.
No, but I'll just set them up on a draft on your account.
See, now I'm scared. You got me scared.
All right, any more questions?
I think we got all the questions. No, I think we got them all.
All right.
Dave, while Matt is switching to the next topic, so Dave Franicky came and chimed in. He was like, Zarina lives near Fostoria. I'm sure she'll go by and do the property inspection. And just behind the scenes,
right.
I told Dave he drank the wrong Kool-Aid today. So he needs to. That's not happening.
Yeah, we're not going to put you out in the neighborhoods, that's for sure.
Right. I ain't driving by nothing. So
you could go hook that car up and pull it out of that yard, though.
What? Whatever.
Just take your tow truck and pull them cars out of the yard.
I thought so I had a station wagon. Now it's a tow truck?
Yeah, we upgraded you to a tow truck.
You upgraded me. Okay. All right. I moved up from a station wagon, y'all. This is good. I'm making progress here.
My goodness. All right.
All right.
Next.
I think it's time to move on. So next we've got up Teresa, and I'm gonna pull her off or pull her on, and then Zarina, are you ready for me to pull it over?
Switch
to
over,
you?
Yeah.
So Teresa, are you good to go? Is your mic working?
I am.
Hello, Teresa. Yes. How are you?
Good. I had a question regarding amortization schedules and entitlements for partials, and so I was hoping that you could just walk through the model, because either I was looking at it when I was tired or something, the math just didn't seem to add up for me when I looked at this particular spreadsheet that she has up, and looking at the full amortization and the partial amortizations.
Gotcha. So this is putting my calculator here on the spot, because hopefully I did all my math correctly. Mm-hmm. On this particular calculator, this is one that I have for the pricing course. So if there's any mistakes in it, they're all mine, so this is no pressure. But anyhow, just put some numbers in here. So on this particular deal, we're just going to do $80,000 unpaid balance, or you know, no payments, just to kind of fill in these numbers here. So $80,000 principal, 8%, 360 months, payment comes out to $587 and 1 cent. So that's what we're going to use as our note. And then what that's going to do is just kind of populate this amortization. So let's scroll up here. So this is what's called the full AM, and AM is short for amortization. And you see it begins here with month 360, here's the payment. It tells you how much of that is principal, how much is interest, and then the balance is $80,000. So this is the full 360 months for this particular deal, and then on this calculator it kind of shows little timestamps at 5 years, 10 years, what these unpaid balances are. So when you're going back on this one, this blue field here is what is going to populate the partial amortization and the partial chart. So on this one, we can plug in, this is a little bit too much return, so let's plug in, let's see, $40,000 partial here, and we'll do, oh, we can do more. Let's just get as high as we can, 50. Okay, so $50,000 partial on this for 120 months gives us 7.25, which is a decent enough return for this example. So if we go over here to this partial chart, we have this one starting 120 months, balance is $50,000, and then it just runs through the rest of these payments. So it's totally separate from this full amortization here, which has a balance of $80,000. So you'll have to look at this concurrently. So let's say, for instance, 60 payments into this partial, the whole note pays off. And you want to figure out, okay, how much is the unpaid balance of the loan? How much is my investor getting? How much am I getting? Things like that. You would not look necessarily on just the partial amortization. You're going to look on the full amortization. So if we go down to payment number 60, which is here, the unpaid balance is $76,055.89. The partial amortization at 60 months, which is here, is $29,469. So what you would do is say, okay, here's 76. This is the total payoff, and this is what I still owe the investor for having this partial. So you just do a simple calculation, which I can do now. Let's see. 76,055.89 minus partial says 29,469.19. So you would pay the investor their unpaid balance of 29,000 and change, and then you would keep 46,586.
Okay, that makes sense, so the partial is a subset of the full.
Yes.
Okay. They're not two separate where you would add them together. So it's a subset. I was thinking it was separate, so you'd have to combine them when you went to, if it paid off early, but that clarifies it. It's a subset.
Mm-hmm. So you would, if it pays off early, whatever the unpaid balance on this partial schedule, you would take away from this full schedule.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any questions on this? Lisa said, then you do the happy dance. Yeah, that is actually a pretty good deal. If you're keeping $40,000. Yeah, that's pretty nice. Or 46 or whatever, I just calculated.
Not too shabby.
I know, because you bought it for... What did we buy it for? 57.
20? Oh, did you buy it for? Oh, 57. Okay.
Yeah, 57, right? So.
Yep, wouldn't be too bad.
Karen is asking, where can you find this calculator? Matt, you want to show them, or you want me to show them?
I actually have it up, so if whenever you're ready, I can I can pull it over, and it'll actually be on the screen whenever we pull it over.
Okay, so this, I'll tell them where it is just in case somebody else has a question that wants to calculate something. But this is in Module 3 of the Performing Notes side of the website. If you just go to Module 3, you'll see a bunch of links to a pricing course that is not yet finished. But the download for this particular calculator is there. So, Matt, you want to go ahead and show them?
Yeah, so just... So when you're at your main page, of course, I had it up. So when you're at if you go to your train tab and go over to Module 3, click on that, the power quoter delta under pricing, or Module 3 under pricing, it's that very first bold sentence with the blue power quoter link. So you can download that from there, and it's definitely it's a very good tool for that. So, yeah.
Very cool.
All right. So as of right now, I don't see really any other questions that have come through. So we are in what we call open mic. So anyone has a question, anyone wants to bring something to the call, you can go right ahead and raise your hand or type it into the board, and we will we'll get on that. So otherwise, cool. we'll you know, go ahead and
move on with our announcements.
Yeah. So I don't see any hands or any...
I see some hands. There's three of them.
Yep. Now I see. All right. I'm just going to kind of do them in reverse alphabetical order as they stand. So I'm going to go ahead and go with Co.
Ooh, nice.
Co, go ahead.
Hi. This is a follow-on question to the partial and the early payoff and how you calculate different amortizations. I have admittedly have not sold a partial yet or written one of those contracts, but what I'm wondering is it was described as you're actually giving them the entire contract with a reversion right when their payment stream ends, then you get it back again. What prevents them from getting the full amount of the payoff? If
well,
they open the note at the time of the early... Yeah.
Yeah, when it's paid off, all of the payments, when you're involved with a partial, all of those payments are being sent through a servicer. So they're not exactly touching, you know, all of the funds immediately, and they're just going to snatch your money and run off with it. So when a payoff is initiated, your servicer is going to be the first person to know because they're going to call and say, hey, what's the payoff? We're selling this house. And then everybody should be alerted to, okay, they want to pay off. Let's run these numbers. Let's get everything in order. And your servicer is fully aware that they are a partial investor, meaning they are not entitled to the entire payoff amount. So there's plenty of hands touching this where they won't run off with your $40,000.
Okay. Well, that's what you want. So, but is there in your partial contracts that we set up, is it clear that if there's early payoff, they are entitled to the payoff at their partial amortization schedule?
It should be. I haven't read the contract yet.
I haven't done one of those. That's what I say. Admittedly, I have not read it. I was just curious.
Yeah.
But, if what you're saying is the way it normally works, I presume that's actually in the standard partial contract. Okay, thank you.
And the reason why this partial contract is so powerful is because Mr. Speed and Ms. Speed worked with Jeff and a couple of other people to actually put in some protection language for when something pays off early.
Oh, nice.
The borrower or the partial investor is legally contracted to only have their portion of the payoff that goes to
them.
So it was specifically written for this type of instance. So because the old partial agreements didn't have, and some other servicer partial agreements don't have this type of language in it. And I sat there and we were talking to Mr. Reed, and he was like, we specifically wrote this for that type of issue because this happens very commonly. So, after a few years, it's very likely that it will pay off. And to be protected as the seller, that's why there's a seller partial agreement and a buyer agreement, because the protection in that language that protects you is very specific to paying off and stuff like that. So,
cool.
That is in the contract. And there's also, I don't know if you've looked on it, the Summer Summit or the Appreciation Event from last.
I was just going to say that.
Has.
So we have.
Go ahead, Jerry.
We have video with, it was a panel with Eddie, Martha, and Jeff Watson, and they were specifically covering the details of the partial contract. So for many people, it kind of went over their head because they weren't doing partials. But for those of you guys who are looking to do partials or are currently doing them and you want somebody who knows this contract in and out to kind of discuss the main features of it, that would be a really good place to start. So where you would find that, you're going to go to the on-demand training under the training tab. You're going to click the appreciation event videos and scroll down to where it's starts talking about partials. And it's Jeff Watson, Martha Speed, mostly those two talking about it.
Super. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Matt, let's go to the people who still have their hand raised, and then we'll kind of circle back to all the people kind of typing stuff in. Bill Griesmer.
Good evening, Zarina. Thanks for talking to me here. For the audience, I talked with Zarina briefly last week about selling a non-performing note, brokering one. My question is, obviously it's whatever you can negotiate, but can you give me an idea of what to ask to broker a note, and if there's a difference in what you ask if you broker either a performing or a non-performing note?
Sure. So on performing notes, it's much easier to find what you're going to make, because on performing notes, what you do is you take, you know, usually the colonial price is somewhere around 12%, so we're just going to use that for this example, and you sell it for less than that. So your return, if you bought it, you know, straight out of the box is a 12% yield, and maybe you told your investor, I can get you a 7.5% or an 8% or whatever number that you told them, and then you just do the math from there, saying, okay, I bought it for $50,000 at 12%, I can sell it for $45,000, or not 45, but $65,000 for 8%. And you know that $15,000 is what you're going to make, because it's that 4 points or 5 points. On non-performing, it's a little bit trickier because of the way that the pricing is set up. So that's actually more of an arbitrary number, like, okay, what should I budget for? So what I would do on a non-performing is actually budget as if I was going to work out the asset and then find out how much wiggle room I have in the price that I could present to somebody else. So let's say, for instance, you bought a deal and you bought the note itself for $30,000, and then by the time you're done with workouts and foreclosure and whatever else, trash outs, your all-in price was going to be $65,000 and you were going to make a $20,000 profit. Then you can arbitrarily say, you know what, I could charge this person anywhere from $5,000 to $8,000 more because they're going to make a pretty decent profit off of this note, and then that's how you would do that. So you're really budgeting for the entire workout and then backing into a number, versus on a performing note, you kind of know at the beginning because you're just taking that 4-point spread.
So you really don't pay attention to the unpaid balance or the BPO is what you're saying then?
Well, the BPO is going to help you with budgeting. But the unpaid balance, I mean, it's a non-performing loan. So that's sort of arbitrary. I mean, if they do a principal reduction, that unpaid balance means nothing. So just back, you know, kind of work it out budget-wise how you would do anyhow, and then back yourself into a number that's comfortable enough to leave your investor with a profit, but also kind of pay you for your time.
Okay.
And Bill, if that's something that you really want to drill down into, send that question into content, and on the non-performing calls, we'll definitely get some time, do some work,
and we'll
drill down into that non-performing side of doing that.
Yeah, I was going to do that. It's just, you know, you asked for volunteers, so I figured I'd volunteer. So I appreciate it.
Sneak it in here.
Sneaking it in. All right. Thanks, Bill. Pete Smith.
I'll get Pete.
Yeah, let's get Pete on here.
Mouse is moving slow. There we go. Pete, go ahead.
Can you hear us, Pete?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me?
We can now.
Oh, I had pressed the wrong button, and so I really didn't have a question.
Oh. Wah, wah, wah.
Well, it was good to know that your mic works for when you do have a question.
Exactly, yes.
All right, thank you. Yeah, this All was right. a test.
All right, thanks.
All right, let's go to Mark Bruce. Oh, man, there's a lot of hands up. Charles, put your hand down.
I was just wondering what that button was for. See, I'll say that hand wave and it's mine. I don't have a question.
All right, Mark, you're muted.
Yes, I have a couple rental properties that I want to sell to an investor and do owner financing, and I've got the investor lined up. I understand because I'm selling it to an investor, I don't need to use an RMLO. Is there a recommendation or documentation on how I go about selling the properties to an investor?
So these are things that you want to sell the property outright to him as rentals, or you want to do a 50-50?
No, they're in Baltimore. I own them outright. I want to sell them 100% to him.
Okay. So, as an owner finance, so have you? He's going to buy all of them from you. So, are you going to sell it to him like sort of in a one-shot deal, or are these like one at a time as you're kind of negotiating prices?
I'll probably do both of them at one time.
Okay.
Probably on one note.
Okay. Oh, so you're going to cross-collateralize.
There's a tax issue. One,
great
on price, but the city has valued the lower-priced one at a higher value and the higher value one at a lower value, so to keep his tax bills the same.
Okay.
You're just going to tie him up on one note.
Okay. You're
going to put him on a note and deed of trust?
Is that have a note and a deed of trust drawn up and do the closing like that?
I mean, yeah. I mean, you could have an attorney draw up your paperwork for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since you're not using an RMLO, you could just give an attorney. Even if you knew somebody had a local title company, you could get them to draw it up. I usually use an attorney to draw up paperwork for me.
Yeah, especially if you're going to cross-collateralize like that.
Yeah, because there's probably some type of cross-collateralization language you'll use in there, too,
mm-hmm.
That you are cross-collateralizing them. So, but yeah, you can just get a local attorney, real estate attorney, to do that for you.
Okay.
Yep, super simple. And guys, for those of you guys, before you type it in, cross-collateralize meaning it's one note, but there's more than one collateral securing that note. So in Mark's case, he's doing two houses under one note. So that's why we're recommending him to get an attorney. All right, cool. Just breezing on through, man. Doug Till is next. If we can get him.
Did you say Zarina?
Mr. Till, Doug Till.
All right, leave it here.
Doug, can you hear us? I can unmute him. I don't hear him. Oh, there he is.
Okay. Hi there.
Hey.
Got a question for you. We're new Titanium members, so we were getting ready to pull a trigger on a asset, and when we looked at the asset, when we looked at land contract address was different than what all the other due diligence documents showed. So I was trying to figure out what would go transpire here, that you'd have to get the land contract changed to the correct address.
Matt, could that be just an error? Just us linking the wrong info to the wrong note?
Doug, if you'll send that in to us at content, we'll look at that just to make sure. Because without the document, without knowing everything, it's hard to make that correct assessment of that. So just send that back in, and me or Charles, I'll look at that, and then if there is an issue that Charles needs to step in, I'll prove it up to him, and then he can answer that if it's the name on the contract is correct, however the address is incorrect, you know, something like that. So.
Yeah.
If you'll just send in the loan number, I'll look at the link and we'll check that out.
Okay, I'll send that in to you. And then I got one more question, if I could.
Sure.
Whenever you do buy an asset, I kind of heard something the other day about taking about $500 to board an asset. So if a servicer is already there, for example, if Peak is already servicing the note, do we have to pay that boarding fee again?
You don't have to pay that boarding fee. You'll want to confirm with Peak. I don't think, Peak doesn't charge $500 to board an asset.
I think he's talking about the colonial closing fee, Charles.
Yeah, well, it could be there's a couple of things. I know NAA has a boarding fee when you board an REO with NAA. It's $500. And then there's of course, when you buy a note, there's a $500 processing fee when you purchase a note, which you may be thinking of that as well. But typically, a boarding fee is not, they vary, but they're not that much. They're depends on which servicer it is, but there could be $50 to $75 to board a loan. But they're usually not that much. But because the loan's already boarded with Peak, I'm not sure what their fee is that when they transfer it over to you. But it's not $500, trust me.
Okay, yeah, I just heard that on one of the calls there, and it kind of got me wondering there.
Yeah, we were either talking about probably the boarding fee for NAA for REOs or something.
Yeah.
Or NAA, yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about that case, that a couple of case studies that we did that we boarded with NAA that lowered BPOs, and then we actually sold them for, you know, probably four times what the BPO was showing. But NAA does they do a boarding fee of $500, and that basically does it, puts it in the system. They go out, they inspect the property so that they can get a property a proper valuation of what the property should sell for. So that, I believe that's what you're talking about, Doug.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Oh, look, it's Jason Ortiz next. All hey, right. Jason.
Hey, hopefully it's not too much feedback. I don't have my headphones on, so.
Oh, it sounds good.
Okay, good. Must be Mac. Go Apple. Hey, so my question was, do servicers hand off their escrow account information to the next servicer to ensure the continuity of the loan when the service is transferred? And if not, why not? Seems like there's a lot of valuable account history that's lost if they don't.
No, the escrow, the servicers usually transfer the escrow information and the escrow account to the new servicer. So typically, if you have a positive escrow account, you move the servicing, the loan boards with your servicer, the new servicer, and then usually within a week, 10 days, the old servicer will send the escrow funds by check or by ACH to the new servicer, and they set up the escrow account. But yes, that information transfers over. However, when a new servicer takes on an escrow account, they should be getting an updated tax cert just to make sure that the taxes, you know, that are reported are the correct taxes. And I think most servicers do that. When they set up their accounts, they'll update their update the tax information to verify taxes are paid or what's coming up due. So, but yes, that information does transfer.
So Charles, when Rocktop, like for instance, the note that I'm referring to is the one that I'm purchasing, or basically Rocktop, Colonial purchased it from Rocktop, and then I purchased it from Colonial, and Pete is the servicer for Colonial, and I'm staying with Peak as my servicer. The indications I got from Peak were that they didn't have any of the historical information from Rocktop, other than just the basic documents. So I don't know if I was misunderstanding, but I thought I asked John.
Well, okay, now, as far as historical information, so do they receive what was paid 5 years ago out of the escrow account? Not likely. A lot of times these may transfer servicing several times before we ever acquire them. So what you want to make sure of is that the current escrow balance transfers, which it does. So if there's $500 in the escrow account, you want to make sure that $500 gets transferred to Peak, or, you know, Peak transfers that service, that $500. Now, I'm not worried about past historical information on escrow. I'm worried about current historical information. I want to know the taxes are paid, and I'm going to have them do me an updated tax search just to make sure, you know, that they do an escrow analysis and the taxes are current. So I'm not real concerned about historical data. I never go back and look at what happened 3 years ago on a loan with their escrow unless there's a problem. I mean, I have gone back once or twice and had to research something further back. You know, it's not likely that you're really going to need the historical data years back. You want to know what's due today.
So if Colonial bought the asset from Rocktop, then they would have already transferred the escrow amounts from Rocktop servicer over to Peak, and so when I pick it up from Peak here shortly, it should be there?
Yeah.
It's there, yes.
Got it.
Yeah, you have nothing to worry about.
Excellent. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.
Serena?
Right.
Serena?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say we probably need to kind of close down open mic because we are at 9 o'clock. So just to let you know.
And I think we have some announcements, don't we, Matt?
Well, we are less than a month away from a very big event that we've got in Texas, which is kind of the reason why I'm not going to be in Colorado. We've got our summer summit coming. June 2nd, we actually have the special class, which is the Dykes Botiford Entity Creation and Protection class. There is a little bit of information that I need to talk about on that. So if you look at the handouts right now, there is a a handout about where the alternative accommodations are, because all of the booking blocks or hotel block bookings have been used up for the hotel that we are the first choice. But we did talk with some of the groups around there, and there are some other options for staying that the night of the second if you come in early for that class. So if you look at the handouts, just download that, and that information will let you know if you're coming to the Dive Spot for class on the second. There are some other options for you to stay at. Other than that, after the second, we are going to have our summer summit starting the third and fourth. Got a lot of really big information coming out there, and some big announcements that are gonna start out. I know the office is super busy getting it ready. So that's the third and fourth. There will be a titanium event the evening of the June 3rd, and also there is the dinner with the Speeds on the June 4th. So if you have any questions, and I know I had some people reach out to me asking for some information on that, if you have not received any feedback, please let me know so that I can push back to make sure you get that. But that will take place June 4th as well. So if those who have bought the charity event auction dinner with Speed for the gourmet dinner, then you will enjoy that. And then, of course, the third through the fifth, there is a Rich Rewards class that will be taking place the entire time. On the June 4th, before we close for that evening, we will take a kind of a straw poll or a hand up, kind of how many people are going to stay. So if you are going to stay, we'll get that information then, and so that we have enough room at that class. So did I leave anything else, Charles? Oh, there is a pool.
Yep, we'll release a tape tomorrow afternoon, so everybody watch for that. We'll send out an email notification once we release it.
All right. Yeah, so now that'll probably be near the end of the day after the call that we do for tomorrow. Isn't that correct, Charles?
Right. Yeah, it'll probably be right after our call tomorrow afternoon. So, nice. Again, we'll send out an email blast. And so I'm assuming that Zarina and I will be hosting the call tomorrow. I think we're just going to change the name of this to the Charles and Zarina Show, right?
Hey.
I like how Charles took first billing on that, by the way, Zarina.
That's all right. That's all right. It's alphabetical order. That's all he did. That's all he did.
That's right.
It's all good. Just really quickly before we shut down, there's a couple of announcements that are on the forum. And Bob asked me to mention that we are underutilizing the forum. So I actually have I have the green light on a Ohio meetup. So the details or the announcement or something is on the forum. So if you want to check that out, if you live in or near Ohio and want to join us, that would be cool. So just let me know.
Absolutely.
I'll be there.
No, Charles, it's us four and no more. That's it.
Okay, I got it. I know how to do it.
You can't come. You're going to mess up the flow.
Not now.
Oh, shoot.
All right, everybody. Is that it?
Yeah.
That's it.
Everybody have a great evening. Thank you all for joining us. We'll see you soon.
See you tomorrow. Bye, guys.
Good night.